Good morning. Republicans and Democrats are in a redistricting arms race. One analyst says fewer swing districts means more gridlock in Congress, giving the president and judges more power. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The new leader of the Democratic Party says he is tired of bringing a pencil to a knife fight against Republicans. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. So what do Democrats see as their proverbial knife? Also, Taylor Swift sang about a fairy tale proposal. Now she's had one of her own. We'll speak with USA Today's full-time Taylor Swift reporter about why so many people care so much. It's Wednesday, August 27th. On this day in 2008, Barack Obama became the first black presidential nominee from a major party. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. 50% tariffs on Indian goods take effect today, some of the highest in the world. NPR's Dia Hadid reports the Trump administration says the move is in response to India's ongoing purchases of Russian oil.
The tariffs signal a stunning collapse in relations after decades of bipartisan policy to strengthen India to counter a muscular China. America is India's largest export market, and the tariffs are likely to impact half that trade, worth between $50 billion to $60 billion. Traders have already halted some exports to the US, including frozen shrimp. Washington accuses India of fueling the invasion of Ukraine through its purchases of Russian oil. But it has not sanctioned the other chief buyer, China. India says it will not halt its purchases for now. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Mumbai.
President Trump held a marathon cabinet meeting at the White House on Tuesday to highlight his crime-fighting efforts in Washington, D.C. NPR's Tamara Keith reports that Trump also received plenty of praise from his top officials.
Trump boasted that bringing in thousands of National Guard troops and federal agents has made the nation's capital safe, and said he wants any murders committed in the district to be punished by the death penalty. Trump also repeated a line he has used several times lately, saying people would be okay with a dictator.
If he stops crime, he can be whatever he wants. I'm not a dictator, by the way, but he can be whatever he wants. I think it's going to be a big subject for the midterms, and I think the Republicans are going to do really well.
This set a record as Trump's longest event ever. Tamara Keith, NPR News, the White House.
Tech companies in Silicon Valley are pouring more than $100 million into a campaign to block new rules on artificial intelligence. NPR's Bobby Allen reports the effort comes as states begin to weigh a series of AI regulations.
A network of political action committees known as Leading the Future will begin fanning out across states, including New York, California, and Ohio. While Congress has not enacted any AI laws, states have been busy at work. The group fighting back includes tech leaders from the firm Andreessen Horowitz and executives at OpenAI. They plan to argue in digital ads and to state lawmakers that AI regulations could hurt innovation and give China an edge in AI development. The tech execs are pushing back against what they see as AI doomers, who they say fear societal upheaval. But AI critics say while places like Europe rein in AI, the U.S. is making a mistake by taking a largely hands-off approach. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
This is NPR News in Washington. The Food and Drug Administration has suspended the license for a chikungunya vaccine. NPR's Jonathan Lambert reports the decision leaves the United States with just one vaccine against the mosquito-borne illness that's on the rise globally.
Chikungunya disease is very rare in the U.S., but causes severe joint pain in hundreds of thousands of people worldwide each year. In 2023, the FDA-approved vaccine called IXCHIQ, manufactured by Valneva. In the U.S., it's given mostly to travelers. In May, FDA and the European Union equivalent recommended a pause in the use of the vaccine in older adults after reports of the vaccine causing symptoms of the disease itself. Both agencies reversed the pause in early August, but last week, the FDA pulled the vaccine's license. In response, Valneva said the adverse events are in line with what was reported before approval. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
Three, two, one.
After a series of setbacks, SpaceX was able to launch its massive Starship rocket from a facility in South Texas last night. The 400-foot rocket deployed 8 dummy Starlink satellites into orbit before both stages splashed down safely. Company officials say the mission met all of its major objectives, delivering crucial data to help refine the rocket's design. Stocks across Asia traded mixed today. Markets in Hong Kong and China closed lower, while shares in Japan were higher. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
At first, silent pictures were a diversion between live vaudeville acts. But a decade into the 20th century, vaudeville theater owner John H. Keenan could read the writing on the wall. Film was here to stay. Vaudeville wasn't. So Keenan turned to a new business venture, building and running a Tunnel of Love type attraction at state fairs. He called his ride Ye Old Mill. Arkansas, Oklahoma, Iowa all got one. Then in 1915, Keenan brought Ye Old Mill to the Minnesota State Fair. A mill wheel churned the water channel, which shot boats and passengers along darkened tunnels, occasionally lit by curious scenes of forest critters, trees, and elven creatures. Over a century later, Ye Old Mill still hurdles people of every age into the dark. It's the oldest attraction at the Minnesota State Fair and the last of John H. Keenan's mill rides, still intact in its original form.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Good morning. President Trump's push for Texas to redraw congressional lines ahead of the midterms has triggered a redistricting arms race. More states are expected to follow as control of the House in 2026 comes down to just a few seats. In a few minutes, we'll talk to a Republican state representative in Indiana pushing for new maps that would make it harder for Democrats to get elected there. But first, NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh reports that mid-decade gerrymandering doesn't only affect voters. It could also further erode the constitutional power of the People's House.
Republican Congressman Kevin Kiley's district runs along most of California's border with Nevada. But under a new map drawn by Democrats, it won't exist anymore.
It's going to be incredibly disruptive for representative government in our state.
Kiley says voters want legislators who know their districts inside and out.
I mean, if just all of a sudden you have communities tossed out of your district that you've come to know, they've come to know you, you understand their issues.
He says it only increases polarization.
We disagree on enough as it is, but if we can't agree on the basic rules of the road, the rules of the game, the basic parameters of our politics, then we're really in big trouble.
Kiley is one of five Republicans who could be out of a job if voters in California approve the new map. Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom pushed the changes to respond to the move by Texas Republicans to redraw their maps in a way that would cost five Democrats their seats. Sean Trendy, an elections analyst with Real Clear Politics, says this opens the door to a never-ending redistricting loop.
You know, in this current nasty polarized environment, you can see that, like, parties draw the map and then one of their incumbents looks kind of wobbly, and so they redraw it to shore that member up.
Trendy says this could result in a non-functional House, because with fewer swing districts, there will be fewer moderates with incentives to reach across the aisle.
It almost compounds things when you have these super safe seats, because you have members who have just zero interest in even taking like an 18th of a loaf.
The House was designed to be closest to the people, but more partisan districts increases gridlock, which Trendy says ends up shifting power to the executive and judicial branches.
So it really is a movement away from what's supposed to be our most responsive democratic branches to the more unelected branches who are more insulated from public opinion.
While blue California and red Texas have already jumped into the redistricting game, they won't be the last. Ohio was already planning to redraw its lines. Republicans in Indiana and Missouri could follow suit, and potentially Florida too. A judge just threw out Utah's map, so the GOP is facing a challenge to redraw lines there. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries blames President Trump for the frenzy.
They started it, but we're not going to let them finish it.
Democrats need to pick up 4 seats to win back the House and block Trump's agenda. To do so, Jeffries told NPR, Democrats are going to take the redistricting fight coast to coast. Blue states like Maryland, Illinois, and maybe Oregon could move to counter GOP gains.
Republicans are trying to shrink the map, and we are not going to let that happen.
The top House Democrat says the GOP turned to redistricting as a way to keep their majority because the president's agenda is broadly unpopular.
It's because they have failed to govern in a manner that makes life better for the American people.
Lawmakers on both sides say the way to end the redistricting fever is to ban states from redrawing lines mid-decade and to hand the power to independent commissions. But no one believes either of those things will happen soon. And without reform, the doom loop of redistricting and polarization will just keep spinning. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, Washington.
Okay, Deirdre mentioned my home state of Indiana, which is one of the states where Republicans are talking of redrawing congressional district lines, although they seem to be divided on that question. Dozens of Republican lawmakers from Indiana visited the White House yesterday, and their meeting touched on redistricting. One of them was Republican State Representative Andrew Ireland, who represents some of the outlying areas of Indianapolis, the capital. Welcome to the program, sir.
Hi, good morning. Good to be with you.
Glad you're with us. Now, I just want to do a little bit of math here. During Trump's time, the last decade or so, Indiana has been roughly a 60-40 state, about 60% Republican. In Congress, you've got 7 of 9 Republican seats already, which is way more than 60% Republican. And the idea is to make it even more Republican, maybe unanimously Republican. Do you really want to make it 9 out of 9?
Well, listen, I think that there's a strategic disadvantage at the national level for Republicans in Congress because of, you know, partisan gerrymandering in other states like our neighbor Illinois. And right now we have a leader in our party that I think is, you know, recognized that, you know, issue. And, you know, we can sit on our laurels and say that, you know, we have this map that, you know, the Princeton Election Lab, for example, rates as one of the least gerrymandered in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, we can get in the fight and we can level the playing field. And I think that's the conversation we're having now.
Okay, you're making an argument, as Democrats are, that the other guys are doing it more. But I want to focus just for a moment on the state of Indiana. You were quoted as saying Democrats, quote, have no business representing us in Washington. Is that a thing you said?
That's right. And I'll say that because, you know, you look at Indiana and the political makeup, yes, we're 60-40, but also Democrats have not won over the average Hoosier in a statewide vote for more than a decade in a single office. I think that says a lot about where the party is, that it no longer connects with the average Hoosier voter. There's something to be said that we should have congressional maps that, one, reflect the average Hoosier voter. They don't, you know, really kind of swing hard to one party or another, but actually just swing to the basic average within the state.
Mm-hmm.
And then if Democrats can't win that, I mean, that's on Democrats and the fact that they're not focusing on policies and issues that matter.
Although I was looking at those recent elections, and you're right, Republicans have won big in this era in Indiana. Previous decades, they did better. Democrats did better, but Republicans are dominant now. And yet it would seem that more than 1 million Hoosiers disagree with you, because that's the number that voted for Democrats for president or for governor in 2024, well over 1 million. That would include a majority of people in Indianapolis, the city you represent. Are you dismissing the wishes of your own constituents?
No, I'm not. And I'll say, I mean, take Massachusetts, for example. It also has 9 congressional seats. The political makeup is almost exactly the same, 60-40, but mm-hmm. Democrat to Republican. But in Massachusetts, the same for all of New England, is entirely a Democrat congressional delegation. Indiana, you know, again, if you're going to level the playing field and we're going to play, you know, by a system that really evens out the kind of the partisan split in Congress, I don't think there's anything been wrong for Indiana to take a similar approach.
I think you can make the case about Massachusetts, and I think about that sometimes. If you're a Massachusetts Republican, it's got to be very, very frustrating, but it sounds like you want the same thing for Indiana.
Well, and I'll tell you this, too. I mean, candidly, I would like to see a world where Congress steps in and does its job to rein in partisan gerrymandering. But until Congress does its job, I think states have an obligation to really protect the interests of the majority, in particular, you know, in aggregate, the national scale. And right now, you know, candidly, states like Indiana have kind of sat by and said, even though Illinois is doing this, even though California, Maryland, other states, that we're going to sit back and try to do it the right way. And I respect that. I think there's something to be said for that. But at the same time, you can't put your partisan, you know, kind of bend, I think, at a strategic disadvantage on a national level and really marginalize your own voters in the process.
You know, I do have to mention there are a number of Democratic-led states where they've put these nonpartisan processes in place. In fact, California's one. That's what they're now backing out of in response to the redistricting in Texas. It's not like Democrats have made no effort in this side, but I'm just thinking this through. If Democrats should win one election in Indiana, which I grant is unlikely now, should they have the right to just shut you out of power forever?
Well, let me push back first on saying that, you know, we have these nonpartisan commissions, and yes, they're nonpartisan in name, but I think if you look at the political affiliation of the individuals that staff them, rarely are they truly nonpartisan. But I will say, yeah, of course, you know, if Democrats win elections in Indiana, then, you know, they are given the constitutional right to draw maps. And again, I would encourage them to really focus on issues that matter to Hoosiers. And maybe they would have a little more luck at the ballot box, but they really haven't. They're out of touch with the average voter, and that's why they're in the predicament they're in now.
Indiana State Representative Andrew Ireland, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Have a good morning.
Scientists have documented a new shark and it's orange.
What?
Yeah.
I have never seen a nurse shark with that color.
Daniel Arouse co-authored a study on the shark published in the journal Marine Biodiversity. Arouse says the 6-foot-long shark was caught by a group of sport fishermen off Costa Rica and released.
These guys took a bunch of pictures of the shark. You know, they are usually yellowish, grayish, but that was like bright orange and was like almost like golden. It was crazy. And it also had these white eyes.
Looked like a goldfish. Arouse is executive director of the Rescue Center for Endangered Marine Species, an NGO based in Costa Rica. He says the color is very much like a big goldfish, and it comes from a rare genetic mutation.
This is a chromatism mutation. It's similar to what you will call albino animals, right? Or melanistic animals. In this case, it's called xanthism with an X.
Xanthism in other animals causes the bright yellowish pigmentation in fish, frogs, and even some snakes.
In this case, Arouse says it's particularly rare.
This shark actually has both mutations. It has a mutation for albinism, which is why the eyes are all white, and it also has a mutation for xanthism. We have never seen that in a shark before.
Nick Whitney, a senior scientist for the New English Aquarium, specializes in nurse shark research.
It's cool to see. It's incredibly rare. We now know that this can happen. We have a really good photo documentation of it.
Although he wasn't involved in the study, Whitney thinks the 6-foot-long shark seems to be doing swimmingly.
As far as the shark is concerned, it probably has no idea that it's yellow. And this one seemed to be a healthy, probably newly mature adult.
It's grown out of the phase when being camouflaged was most important.
In those early years of life, being yellow like that may have made it stand out more, but it seems to have survived that just fine.
Long enough to swim into the spotlight. This is NPR News.
Thank you.
Join us Saturday, September 6th for Grand Rapids River Fest. I'm Jennifer Barr, and I am so excited for this year's lineup. Music starts at 3 o'clock with Alan Sparhawk, a prolific and versatile musician best known as the frontman of Low. His many side projects over the years reveal a musician unafraid to experiment. Then we'll hear Jeremy Albino. His songs are grounded in the gritty storytelling of classic country music propelled by the rhythms of old school R&B. And then Margot Price. She has something to say but nothing to prove, and in just a few solo albums she has cemented herself as a force in Americana music. We'll end our night with Courtney Barnett, one of Australia's most successful musical exports. She has played many festivals around the world, including Coachella, Bonnaroo, Lollapalooza, and now Grand Rapids River Fest. Find tickets and more info at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. See you September 6th.
PR comes from this station. And from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at Viking.com. From Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at EasyCater.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, at macfound.org.
What a morning. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Good morning. Maybe you heard Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce are getting married. The pop star and Kansas City Chiefs tight end posted their news with photos on Instagram. And it does not look like a paper ring. Here's NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento.
Taylor Swift knows how to write about love. For nearly two decades, her personal heartbreaks and disappointments have fueled dozens of major pop hits. When she played at NPR's Tiny Desk in 2019, she said interviewers would often ask her,
"What will you ever do if you get happy? Like, what will you write about? Will you just never be able to write a song again?"
But Swift has never held back from dreaming or singing about her fairy tale wedding. "You'll be the prince and I'll be the princess. It's a love story, baby, just say yes." Romance has often been at the center of both her career and her personal life. In 2023, they intersected in a big way on her record-breaking Eras Tour. Travis Kelce attended one of her concerts. And as he said on the podcast he co-hosts, New Heights,
"If you're up on Taylor Swift concerts, there are friendship bracelets. I received a bunch of them, but I wanted to give Taylor Swift one with my number on it."
Swift ended up getting the memo. She spent over a year playing shows around the world, and she also started a very public relationship with Kelce. Earlier this month, Swift appeared on Kelce's podcast to announce her upcoming album, The Life of a Showgirl. She said it'll be an upbeat project reflecting this period in her life, both on stage and behind closed doors. So even though her heartbreak days are behind her, they'll always be a part of her life and her music. As she told NPR's Tiny Desk,
"In life, you accumulate scars, you accumulate hurt, and if someone's going to take your hand, they'd better take your hand, scars and all."
"Ladies and gentlemen, will you please stand? With every guitar string scar on my head, I take this magnetic force of a man to be my lover."
Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento, NPR News.
Our next guest is Brian West, the full-time Taylor Swift reporter for the USA Today Network. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Steve.
I imagine you were up all night reporting, so thanks for joining us early. I really appreciate it. I see that you have your name on 7 articles about this. What's it like to be the Taylor Swift correspondent right now?
It was a busy day and night. I usually call it a tay-nado whenever there's a firestorm of news because she takes the world by storm, and it is reporting on it and then also doing interviews. But it's fun. It goes by fast.
Okay. Now, one of our colleagues at NPR was observing the photos on Instagram, the spectacular picture of Travis on his knees, and they're surrounded by flowers. And he observed, quote, "It's so cool that a passerby happened to catch this spontaneous moment." What are you learning about how all this came together?
We're learning overnight that Ed Kelsey, Travis's dad, spoke to the ABC affiliate in Cleveland and gave a little bit more details. He said that was in a gazebo that was on Travis's property. Okay. He said it also occurred about 2 weeks ago. He found out on Sunday at a Philadelphia Eagles practice. So if that's the case, that means it might have happened right after the taping of her New Heights episode.
Wow. Okay, so now I'm curious, if this happened 2 weeks ago and you're on the Taylor Swift beat, were there any hints, any leaks, any thoughts this might be coming?
It's interesting because on that podcast, she said she'll never do any Easter eggs when it comes to her personal life, and that was true. But in the most Taylor way, she did announce the news 13 days after the podcast.
What do you mean by that? Oh, 13. Okay, fine. But I'm just curious if it was in the air that this might be happening at all.
He said that he knew Ed Kelsey for a couple months, that Travis had been toying with the idea. His quote was he was going to put it off until even maybe this week. She was getting a little antsy, but he was going to put her off until this week. So it makes some sense that he wanted to do some grand thing or make it a big special event. And Ed said his advice was you could do it on the side of the road. Any place makes it special. And Scott Swift also told him that advice.
Okay, so I want to ask about the Tay-Nado aspect of this. Is that the term you use, Tay-Nado? Do I have that right?
Yes.
Okay. Obviously, anything that Taylor Swift does is going to be news for her millions of fans. People follow everything that she does, everything that she says. Is there something about this particular announcement, though, that takes it to a different level?
This is an engagement that fans have been hoping for. So anybody that's in the storm of the Swiftie universe understands it. They've been following her for 2 decades. They've heard her diaristic lyrics, how she's written about wanting to fall in love and had heartbreak. And so for a lot of them, they were excited about this. But it's not as much of a surprise with Travis, just because over the past year and a half to 2 years that they've been dating, she has hinted to it in the form of when he went to the Eras Tour in Argentina, for example. Her surprise song that night was Endgame, which is a song about ending up with your person or your soulmate. And so she has definitely talked about it when she was on the podcast. She said, you know, I've been writing about this my whole life. And so when this guy showed up, I either thought he's incredibly crazy or he's actually romantic. And it was like an 80s John Hughes movie where someone's standing outside your window with a boombox saying, please date me, please go on a date with me.
Well, what do you think it means for her music and her lyrics having worked her way toward this moment for so long?
So here's what's interesting about just kind of how her life works out. 13, as any Swiftie knows, is her number. She's entering her 12th era, Life of a Showgirl, this fall, which she wrote in 2024 about dating Travis and about the time of her life back then, which would lead to her 13th era is almost what's unfolding now, her bridal era.
Okay, so maybe this is actually going to fit into the plan somehow.
The plan for the future, yes.
Okay. Brian, thanks very much for the update. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
Brian West is the Taylor Swift reporter for the USA Today Network. Let's take it out with Tay-Tay. It's NPR News.
There's a widening gap between how Israelis and the rest of the world perceive the war in Gaza. Much of that is due to how the Israeli media portray the conflict at home.
The first basic role of ours is to inform, to report, and the Israeli media is betraying it.
How the country's mainstream media is covering the suffering in Gaza. On the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you can hear All Things Considered later today at 4 o'clock with your local host, Jennifer Barr. You're listening to Morning Edition here on the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Andrew DeZingle. The KAXE Newsroom has created a map of northern Minnesota farmers markets throughout our region, from places like Park Rapids to Palo, from Black Duck to Crosby. Most markets run through September or October. Find the map at KAXE.org. Happy Dancing Turtle near Pine River invites 4 and 5 year olds to participate in the Tiny Turtles program this fall. Classes begin Monday, September 8th and continue twice a month through November. Classes are held entirely outdoors. Find more info at happydancingturtle.org. Ripple River Gallery, south of Deerwood, hosts the dual exhibit Reclaimed, Reframed, now through September 28th. Featuring sculptures from KAXE's own John Bauer, paired with photographs from Rachel Kane. The exhibit proves that one person's trash is another person's treasure. Open Wednesday through Saturday from 10 to 5 and Sunday 11 to 4. Applications are now open for the University of Minnesota Extension Master Gardener Volunteer Program. Learn how to share science-based horticulture knowledge with people in your area. The course begins in January, and the deadline to apply is October 1st. To learn more, visit z.umn.edu or contact your local extension office. The Central Lakes College Ag and Energy Research Center has its annual field day Friday, August 29th from 9 to 3 at their site in Staples. It's a day of hands-on demonstrations, education sessions, local food, and more. Find a full schedule at clcagandenergy.org/events. And United Way of 1000 Lakes has many volunteer opportunities in Itasca County. Find a list and sign up at volunteer.uwlakes.org.
On today's date, August 27th, in the year 1997, the mountain maple seeds are ripening. Mountain maple is a relative of all the other maples that we are so familiar with, the box elder, the red maple, the sugar maples, all of the maples that you are familiar with, and sometimes the one that gets overlooked is the mountain maple. It's usually a shrub, seldom more than 20 feet high. It has a maple-shaped leaf, and it has a cluster of samaras and seeds that you would expect on a maple. And this time of year, those samara and those seeds become a brilliant coral color, and they're hard to overlook. The leaves of the tree might be starting to turn red, but the seeds are what really grab your eye, those beautiful coral-colored seeds. So watch for the mountain maples and learn to identify them and to appreciate their fall beauty.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Betterment, an automated investing platform that strives to make it easy to be invested. Learn more at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Good morning.
The Democratic National Committee wraps up its summer meeting today in Minneapolis.
According to surveys, the party is unpopular with voters. Its challenge now is to highlight Trump administration policies that, according to surveys, are also unpopular. DNC Chair Ken Martin told his colleagues Democrats need to make a change.
I'm sick and tired of this Democratic Party bringing a pencil to a knife fight. We cannot be the only party that plays by the rules anymore. We've got to stand up and fight.
Here with an update from the DNC's meeting is NPR's Stephen Fowler. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning.
Okay, so this is the first major gathering of the DNC since President Trump's return to the White House. What's the mood?
Well, Layla, depending on who you talk to, there are big feelings about the election, and that election could refer to 2024, 2025, 2026, or 2028. After spending months searching for the right tone and message, or frankly, any tone or message in response to Trump, there was a noticeably aggressive and provocative tack from Democratic leaders this week, including DNC Chair Ken Martin calling the president a, quote, dictator in chief, who said the administration is, quote, fascism dressed in a red tie. Martin also said, as you heard, that Democrats have been bringing a pencil to a knife fight and have been too focused on winning arguments about policy rather than winning elections.
You know what winning the argument gets you? Maybe a nice round of applause and a few likes on Instagram. But the reality is it doesn't make life any better for any person.
Okay, so what do Democrats see as their proverbial knife in this situation? How do they plan on connecting with voters after a pretty tough election in 2024?
Martin's version of the DNC has been in the background, not in the spotlight. They've focused on sending money and resources and attention to state-level parties, who in turn have been using those resources how they see fit. I mean, there is not a leader of the Democratic Party the way Trump is for Republicans, so there's been a lot of leeway with messaging and messengers. Big themes are opposition to Trump's so-called One Big Beautiful Bill and the cuts it makes to social services. They've been highlighting the blatantly partisan redistricting fight going on in several states and being pretty explicit in their view that Trump isn't just violating norms, but Democrats argue he is subverting Congress and the Constitution in a way that is fascism.
This meeting is a small group of party insiders focused on debating changes with how the party operates. Anything notable on that front?
Well, the Rules and Bylaws Committee started the process of figuring out the rules for the 2028 presidential primary calendar. They are planning to meet several more times in the coming months to hash out how they are going to decide who gets to go first. Mm-hmm. There was also a discussion about the party being more active in voter registration and outreach efforts after some folks have sounded the alarm about the party falling behind in key states and polls show them falling out of favor with voters. It's still pretty far off from the midterms, but Democrats are pointing to a string of special elections where they have overperformed expectations, including, Layla, just yesterday, where they flipped an Iowa State Senate seat that was represented by a Republican and now have broken the Republican supermajority there.
That's NPR's Stephen Fowler. Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you.
When Hurricane Katrina made landfall 20 years ago, WWNO's Alana Schreiber was 8 years old. She was growing up in Montclair, New Jersey, where the storm was many miles away. But then a little boy named Nigel Tapp came to her town after fleeing Katrina and enrolled in the Montclair Community Pre-K. And the way his classmates rallied around him still stands out 20 years later. Alana actually lives and works in New Orleans now, and she's here to tell us more. Alana, thank you so much for telling the story.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what do you remember about Nigel and the family from New Orleans that came to your town?
Yeah, so I was in third grade, but I had remained close with my former pre-K teacher, Miss Channon. Her first name is Marcy, but of course, I still call her Miss Channon. So I remember when this little boy, Nigel, came to Montclair along with 30 other family members. His classmates were really attached to him and so devastated when he had to leave before the school year was even over. And after the students and teachers learned that he had lost his house in the storm, they all wrote a book called Nigel and the Hurricane. And they wrote about their memories of Nigel, what they knew about Katrina, and then they would actually sell the book around town to raise money for him and his family.
You actually got in touch with Nigel and reunited his family with the pre-K teacher over Zoom, which is amazing. What was that like?
Yeah, Nigel and Miss Channon were so excited to see each other. They had all these memories, and she explained why she decided the class should write a book in the first place.
something I was really interested in as a teacher was how books can teach us about real things in the world. After Nigel left, I thought, oh, we could write a book.
Nigel was back in New Orleans when the book came out, but he actually remembered learning about Nigel and the hurricane.
It was amazing hearing it because it's like someone cared about me enough to make me a book. And just having a community of people who cared for me at the time, that's not something that everyone who was affected by that tragedy actually got to feel.
And that wasn't all. You actually surprised Nigel with a reunion of his pre-K classmates on Zoom. Tell us about that.
Nigel was so surprised. I mean, 8 former classmates took time out of their day to join on Zoom. And so many of them still have a copy of this book. They brought it to the Zoom meeting. And they started by talking about just how much they missed him after he left. And they reflected that in the pages they wrote. Here's Trin Cavernous and Daniel Rosen.
My page was also about after you left, because we missed you. And me and Tilly would like dig in the ground, and like, you know, sometimes like kids would dig and they say, we're digging at China, and we would try to dig to New Orleans.
I am thinking about my page, how after Nigel and his family went back, we would all line up and we would say, who is missing and who is missing Nigel? And I remember being just profoundly upset when he left, and my parents having to explain to me that, no, it's a good thing, you know, it's, and I was like, no, but he's not here right in front of me, so it's bad.
You know, the kids were so young at the time. Why do you think they remember this so well?
I think it's because of how many lessons they learned packed into one experience. They learned about losing a friend, but they also learned about activism and that they can make a difference. Here's Tobin Williams and Soph Plout.
Almost kind of amazes me is the way that us as kids, right? I mean, we combined the fact of us kind of doing art and kind of drawing in this book with something for the greater good in the community to help out you, Nigel. And I mean, obviously brings us together now and is something that we'll carry with us forever.
I feel like it set a precedent for me that what it means to help people is to do the work to help people. The work is not just getting the resources, getting funds. It's putting yourself on the line and getting your emotions deep in it.
Gosh, speaking of emotions, I'm in tears now. That was WWNO's Alana Schreiber. Alana, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
You are listening to Morning Edition here on the Wednesday Morning Show here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Thanks to our listeners, we've raised over $160,000 during this crisis caused by federal cuts to public media. KAXE is working hard to keep the programming you love going strong. Every action helps. Donate, share our work, or buy a ticket to Grand Rapids Riverfest. Visit KAXE.org. Registration is now open for the Itasca Orchestra Youth Strings Program. Classes begin September 15th. Learn more at register@itascaorchestra.org. United Way of 1000 Lakes hosts the Lumberjack Mile and 5K Saturday, September 6th. Registration begins at 8 a.m., race at 9 a.m. at Grand Rapids Public Utilities. Proceeds benefit the United Way School Pantry Coalition, a network of 11 schools addressing student hunger with nutritious snacks and weekend meals. uwlakes.org/lumberjack. The Friends of the Lake Bemidji State Park have a pancake breakfast Sunday, August 31st from 8 to 10 at the park's dining hall. Bring plates and utensils to help the environment. And the next Summer Muse Festival is Saturday, August 30th from 4 to 8 at Railroad Folk School in Bemidji with artists, musicians, food vendors, and more. Now it's time for more from Morning Edition. Recently, federal funding for all public media was cut. Besides those federal cuts, KXE has also received cuts from the state of Minnesota for programming you love. We wanted to hear from listeners why they think it's important to show their support for KAXE right now.
Hi, my name is Dave, and I'm a supporter of KAXE, and we have lived in 50 Lakes area for about 3 years and loved the music and the news and all the Northern radio shows. And it's become vitally important to us in the car and at home to get our news and music from KAXE. So that's why we feel it's important to keep you guys on the air as long as you want to be on the air. So
make your donation now to help KAXE stay on the air. Go to our website, kaxe.org, and click the word donate.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from AG1, maker of a drinkable multivitamin now available in 3 new flavors, tropical, berry, and citrus. Learn more at drinkag1.com. From Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Good morning. The Trump administration wants to deport Kilmar Abrego-Garcia to Uganda, a country he has no connection to. Abrego-Garcia is the immigrant living in Maryland who was illegally deported by the Trump administration to El Salvador in March. NPR's Scott Newman has been looking into what happens when someone is deported to a third country, and he joins me now. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
Okay, so this case has gotten so much attention, and there have been a lot of twists and turns. So before we get to the likelihood of him getting deported to Uganda, just get us up to speed on Abrego-Garcia's case.
Right. He was returned to the U.S. in June to face human smuggling charges. He was released from custody on Friday, only to be picked up again by ICE agents on Monday. Abrego-Garcia denies the allegations against him. Now, the Trump administration seems determined to deport him again. On Monday, both President Trump and Attorney General Pam Bondi said they want him out of the U.S., and they repeated unproven claims that Abrego-Garcia is a criminal and a member of the MS-13 gang. Here's Bondi in the Oval Office on Monday.
We've got him under control. He will no longer terrorize our country. He's currently charged with human smuggling, including children. The guy needs to be in prison. He doesn't need to be on the streets like all these liberals want him to be.
As for the courts, a judge on Monday granted Abrego-Garcia a temporary stay on his removal while his lawyers fight his deportation. He'll remain in U.S. custody, but won't be going to East Africa, at least not yet. So it really depends on how this plays out in court.
Okay, so if he is removed to East Africa, what exactly will happen?
Immigration and deportation experts I talked to say a couple of agents from ICE's Enforcement and Removal Operations Unit will escort him on a flight to Uganda. He'd likely have his feet and possibly his hands shackled the whole time. Cesar Cuauhtemoc Garcia Hernandez is a law professor at Ohio State University who studies immigration. He says Abrego-Garcia could be flown on a military transport or a chartered passenger jet, such as a Boeing 737. As you can imagine, that's not cheap, so the government could wait and deport him along with others.
And this is why we typically do not see ICE deport one at a time. They are simply too expensive. Now, in this circumstance, would not be surprised if ICE decides that it is worth the money, given the high-profile nature of Mr. Abrego-Garcia's fight.
Arriving in Uganda, there'd be some paperwork to do, and after that, the ICE agents would return to the U.S.
But Scott, has Uganda agreed to any of this?
It has agreed, but as far as we know, we don't really know how the Ugandan government will react once he arrives in the country. We reached out to the Ugandan embassy for comment, but we didn't hear back. Uganda's foreign ministry did say last week that it made a deal with the U.S. to take some deportees, but not people with criminal records. Garcia Hernandez from Ohio State University says the White House's allegations against Abrego-Garcia might be enough for Uganda to conclude he's dangerous and needs to be detained, even though he doesn't have a criminal record. Uganda's foreign ministry also says it prefers to take deportees who are from Africa. For that reason, Uganda might want to pass him back to El Salvador. That could allow the Trump administration to get around a court order that Abrego-Garcia not be sent from the U.S. to El Salvador. An immigration judge found in 2019 that he had a well-founded fear of gang persecution there.
That's NPR's Scott Newman. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from him.
Coming up September 6th, we are so excited for Grand Rapids Riverfest. Opening up will be Alan Sparhawk, who recently talked with Kari Hedlund about his new album with Trampled by Turtles.
I remember the time going like, man, I can't tell if this is any good. I'm questioning myself a lot here, but I don't know. There was a little bit of obligation, I think, because those guys had made room for me, put their trust in me, so to speak. I kind of had to tell myself, you know, I just need to push through and just sing, do the best I can and trust that I'm in the hands of good people. I feel like I did. I found my voice. Thank you for thinking of me, and I'm glad to be there. Mim and I grew up out past Bemidji, so I'm looking forward to it.
Grand Rapids River Fest with Alan Sparhawk opening up, then Jeremy Albino, Margot Price, and Courtney Barnett. Get your tickets at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com.
Turn up the prize.
By week's end, a reminder that import taxes are also for that small package you're waiting for from across the border.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Bitwarden Password Manager, designed to empower travelers with access to secure logins from any device wherever they are, available at bitwarden.com. And by LHH. LHH, a global talent solutions company, combines craft and care to make work beautiful. Recruitment, development, career transition. Learn more at lhh.com/beautiful.
I'm David Brancaccio. You have about another day to get that small package sent in from another country without a new import tax. The tariff exemption for the smaller purchases ends on Friday, and the tariffs start. It's like the duty-free store is closing. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
The exemption is known as de minimis, a Latin phrase describing something trivial or insignificant. In this case, it refers to packages worth $800 or less. The thinking was it wasn't worth trying to collect import taxes on small packages. But starting Friday, those parcels will be subject to the tariff for whatever country they're shipped from. Some countries' postal services say they'll suspend deliveries of packages to the U.S. because of confusion over the new rules. President Trump closed the loophole because he said it was used to send drugs and counterfeit products to the U.S. U.S. Customs and Border Protection says the number of shipments entering the U.S. claiming the de minimis exemption increased by more than 600% over the past 10 years. The end of the exemption could cause supply disruptions and shortages if small packages pile up at customs. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook indicates she plans to sue to stop President Trump from firing her. By law, America's central bank was made independent from the White House and Congress, and any firing would need to be for cause. So far, proof of that cause has not been provided. While Cook is on the team that seems set to cut interest rates by perhaps a quarter of a percentage point 3 weeks from today, President Trump wants rates cut by 3 full percentage points if the Fed becomes more subject to presidential pressure. This could mean higher inflation and a lower dollar. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that.
If the president gets what he wants, yields on U.S. government bonds would fall, and that would make other countries' bonds more attractive. Chuck Tomes at Manulife Investment Management says in that case, if investors in Europe, for instance, decide to sell off U.S. treasuries and buy European ones,
then they would be selling U.S. dollars and buying, say, in this situation, euros as a European investor.
And less demand for the dollar pushes down its value. Another reason investors might sell U.S. dollars is that lower interest rates would probably cause inflation. Sebastian Malaby is senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
You don't want to hold a currency that's going to be devalued by inflation.
President Trump has argued in favor of a weaker dollar, which can make American exports more competitive overseas. But Malaby says more inflation would eat away at those benefits because it would raise production costs here at home.
Because what you gain on the value of the dollar going down, you lose in terms of lost competitiveness because your prices are going up when you produce something in the U.S.
Malaby says as the president's attacks on the Fed's independence continue, along with his attacks on other American financial institutions, the dollar's decline could accelerate. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Market stock index futures at the moment up just slightly.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Baird. Baird strives to attract and retain top financial professionals, providing stability and continuity of advice for clients across market environments. More information at BairdDifference.com. And by This Old House Radio Hour podcast, answering listeners' DIY and renovation questions and diving into home design trends, available in podcast apps.
What was once a maker of graphics chips great for video games went on to learn its technology was great for crunching data for artificial intelligence. Talking about NVIDIA, one of the key AI stocks, later today the company comes out with its spring into summer results and guidance for the road ahead. This is must-see for many investors. Reporter Daniel Ackerman has more.
If you're a tech investor right now, you're not greeting people with the standard, "Good morning, how you doing?" It's more like,
"Happy NVIDIA week."
That's how Gil Luria of D.A. Davidson answered my call.
It's the biggest week of the quarter every quarter now.
There are Super Bowl-like watch parties for NVIDIA's results calls. The chip designer is the most valuable publicly traded firm on Earth.
NVIDIA sits at the center of AI.
Brian Colello is a tech analyst at Morningstar. He says the Amazons, Microsofts, and OpenAIs of the world all rely on chips designed by NVIDIA.
Every developer touches NVIDIA in some way.
Which is why the firm, all by itself, makes up 8% of the entire S&P 500 market cap. Stacey Razgon is an analyst with Bernstein Research.
The amount of growth and profits that we've seen out of NVIDIA over the last several years has just been astonishing. I've never seen anything quite like it, and I've been doing this job almost 20 years.
The company has faced some headwinds, though, says Razgon, particularly of the geopolitical variety. Dating back to 2022...
various levels of export controls that have been placed on their parts specifically for shipments into China.
This month, the Trump administration allowed NVIDIA to sell certain chips to China, but only in exchange for the U.S. government taking a 15% cut of the revenue. And across the Pacific, there are concerns too, says Angelo Zeno of CFRA Research.
The Chinese government is concerned about maybe some of the security issues tied to these chips.
China has speculated there could be some kind of backdoor allowing remote access to the chips. NVIDIA denies that. Zeno says NVIDIA's fate hinges on how this trade spat shakes out.
It's very important for NVIDIA to sell into China because half of the world's developers are actually in China.
Closer to home, says Gil Luria of D.A. Davidson, the limit on NVIDIA's sales doesn't have to do with the chips themselves, but rather with where they ultimately end up.
The bottlenecks now have to do with being able to put up a warm data center in order to plug in the chip.
He says tech firms can't seem to build data centers fast enough, in part because of the grid-straining amount of electricity needed to run the computers and keep them cool.
The computations are so intense that if you don't cool them, they will melt the wires.
Which is why, Luria says, the next big thing in AI is better HVAC. I'm Daniel Ackerman for Marketplace.
And after the internet and many customers did not like Cracker Barrel's corporatized new logo, the restaurant chain has caved and put the fellow with his elbow on the barrel back. Previous logo re-embraced stock in Cracker Barrel Old Country Store Corporation closed up 6% yesterday and is up another 6.5% in pre-market trading right now. I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Begley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Power Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. Looking at weather today, slight chance of rain and thunderstorms, mostly sunny with highs in the mid-70s, low 80s, overnight temps in the upper 40s, low 50s, and tomorrow mostly sunny with highs 68 to 73 degrees. And tune into Headwaters today with Kari Hedlund to hear a conversation.